From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. As a Reuters correspondent in Africa, Aidan Hartley reported on revolution in Ethiopia, atrocities in Rwanda, and suffered the loss of three of his closest friends when they were killed by a mob in Somalia. Hartley was no stranger to the continent. He grew up in Africa and England, part of a British family with a long legacy of colonial service. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Aidan Hartley. His new memoir is The Zanzibar Chest. One reviewer calls the book a sweeping poetic homage to Africa. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new DVD collections of Rocky and Bullwinkle and Friends and The Simpsons. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Millions of people are trying to cope with a massive power outage that stretches from New York and New Jersey to Ohio and Michigan and north into Canada. Officials say it was caused by a malfunction and is not terrorism-related. NPR's Brian Naylor is here with us in the studio. Brian, what do you know about the situation right now?
Corey, the power appears to be coming back on in some areas. It went out shortly after 4 o'clock Eastern Time. In Manhattan, thousands were trapped in subway cars and elevators. Thousands more streamed out onto the streets. Traffic was jammed on the freeways out of Detroit. Flights into airports were stopped. The outage is believed to be caused by a power transmission breakdown in Canada. Officials of the Department of Homeland Security said terrorism did not appear to be a factor. Power was reported out in several Canadian cities as well. And again, it does seem to be coming back on, but officials warn it will take hours to fully restore.
Thank you, Brian. Brian Naylor here with us in the studio. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg says that so far, at least, there have been no reports of injuries as hundreds of thousands of people left skyscrapers and tried to make their way home before dark.
Our advice to people is to be very careful in going home. It is very hot out there. The water supply is safe, and you should drink a lot of water. You should keep your refrigerator doors closed. You should open your windows. It is also important that you turn off all electrical appliances, particularly air conditioners, because as the power comes back, Con Ed and the other power companies will have a very difficult time if the demand is 100%.
New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. New York area airports say they've now restored some services. Throughout the blackout area, people appear to be calm and cooperative. Detroit resident Rosa Blakely says the problem is not just a lack of power, but other utilities that depend on electricity.
The water, because there is no power, therefore you don't have any water coming in. The city, without the electricity, the pumps running the water into your home, you don't have it.
Most hospitals and other emergency service locations are using backup generators, although they've been forced to cut power use to a minimum, which usually means no air conditioning. Power experts say that one reason that the outage is so widespread is that power systems are closely interconnected. If a system experiences multiple failures, it can cause an entire power grid to collapse. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 38 points. It closed at 9,310 in moderate trading of about 1.2 billion shares. The NASDAQ gained 14 points to close at 1,700. This is NPR News. The World Health Organization is helping Canada investigate a possible link between the SARS virus and a respiratory disease outbreak at a Vancouver nursing home. NPR's Richard Knox reports from Geneva.
WHO officials have looked into a number of suspected SARS outbreaks in the last couple of months. Most of them turned out to be the flu, but the Vancouver outbreak is not. And WHO officials are surprised that 10 patients have turned up positive on a gene test for the SARS virus. Several others were positive on a SARS antibody test. Altogether, 143 nursing home residents and staff have fallen ill with the flu-like sickness since July 3rd. Canadian officials think several elderly patients may have died from the illness. The outbreak is on the wane. Health officials are not calling it SARS. Most victims don't have the high fever and diarrhea that usually characterize SARS. WHO officials say scientists need to do detailed analysis of the Vancouver virus. Richard Knox, NPR News, Geneva.
Recapping our top story at this hour, officials of the massive power grid that stretches across the northeast of the U.S. and Canada are struggling to restore power to millions of people who lost electricity today in a widespread blackout. The power failure drove millions of people into the streets when their buildings lost light and air conditioning. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg said there's no evidence so far that the blackout was caused by terrorism. Bloomberg added that there were no reports of injuries as the city's skyscrapers and subways were evacuated. Cities hit by the blackout include New York, Ottawa, Toronto, Albany, New York, Erie, Pennsylvania, Detroit, Michigan, and Toledo, Ohio. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Warner Brothers Pictures and Matchstick Men, a Ridley Scott film with Nicolas Cage and Sam Rockwell as a couple of pros in the small-time con, in theaters Friday, September 12th.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Some foreign correspondents get into the business of war reporting because they thrive on risk-taking and danger. Others are compelled by strong political views. When Aidan Hartley decided to become a stringer in Africa in 1988, he had another motivation. He wanted to return to what he considered his homeland. Hartley spent much of his childhood in Kenya and Tanzania. His father was an agriculturalist in the British colonial service. He was also a descendant of four generations of colonial officers and adventurers who for king and country served and died in Africa and other parts of the world. As a war correspondent for Reuters Wire Service, Hartley covered conflicts in Ethiopia, Rwanda, Somalia, and the Congo. Now he's written a memoir that weaves together stories of his youth, his family's history, and his experiences reporting on war, famine, and violence in post-colonial Africa. It's called The Zanzibar Chest. I asked Aidan Hartley to read a passage from the beginning of his book.
At any one time, we had six wars, a couple of famines, a coup d'etat, and a natural disaster like a flood or an epidemic or a volcanic eruption, all within a radius of 3 hours' flight from Nairobi. You could take off at sunrise, commute to witness a battle, or hear a starving man breathe his last and be back home by nightfall, in time to file a story, take a shower, then hit the Tamarind restaurant downtown for mangrove crab and Stellenbosch. Or you were dropped off watching the plane roar away in a cloud of red dust, and you were gone for weeks, out of contact and 1,000 miles from help. And each time you returned home after a trip like that for a few days, you were as mad as Gulliver talking to his horses. Those were the years when we hitched rides on dawn flights carrying cargoes of blood plasma, guns or baby food to bush airstrips. Flights on battered Antonovs with the word Nazdrovye, cheers, emblazoned on the nose of the fuselage. Flown by Russian crews with the mongoloid faces of Soyuz cosmonauts from my boyhood stamp collection, their breath sour from drink, on $300 a month with girls thrown in, running weapons in the orbit of modern African wars. I recall flights when the passengers sat among boxes of toothpaste and grenades, cement and drums of gasoline. I recall sitting next to a little girl in a frilly pink dress and bonnet and ivory armlets, clutching a yellow-haired Caucasian doll as, below us, broccoli-like black forest stretched for 1,000 miles, unbroken and empty.
That's Aidan Hartley reading from his memoir, The Zanzibar Chest. You worked for Reuters, eventually, the wire service. Now, you covered Somalia, and you arrived there after the militia had overthrown the military dictator, Mohamed Ziad Barre. And you described going to his palace, where his bodyguard, the corpse of the bodyguard, is still rotting in front of his door. And you found a room literally full of envelopes. What did you find there?
Well, it was the typical scene, dictator's palace blown to pieces with various bits and pieces, his documents, incredibly incriminating documents lying all over the place, various members of his regime lying around dead. And we were walking down a passage trying to find, I suppose, documents, find some sort of incriminating evidence that would give us a story about this toppled regime. And we came up against a door that we tried to lean into and open, and it showed some resistance. So he barged it open and we found ourselves standing knee-deep in letters, all of which had been written by supporters of the human rights group Amnesty International to Siad Barre's government, requesting the release of various people who were being held in various detention centres. And none of the letters were opened, and the letters went back for a period of more than a decade. And I picked up a bunch of these and went through them. It really was heartbreaking from people all over the world who'd written thinking that someone would open them. I have no idea how they had identified them, but presumably it was the way that they were addressed, and they'd simply been filed away in a room and ignored. I mean, it never ceases to amaze me that dictatorships seem to save all information that incriminates them. But this is what had happened, and I still have some of the letters, which I have on my desk, and I keep to remind myself of the evil nature of some governments.
Can you talk about the challenge of reporting on what went on in Somalia? I'm thinking that this was among the one of the first times that violent leaders or rivaling clans rose up to take power in the political vacuum after the dictatorship collapsed. Was there even a vocabulary for what was going on?
No. I mean, don't forget that after all of these proxy wars during the Cold War era, these countries had just been, you know, held in the deep freeze. And suddenly they began to disintegrate very fast. What we had thought initially was going to be a wonderful change began to become a lot more complicated, because there was nothing to hold these countries up. Once you took away the guns, once you took away the security apparatus that had been held up by both Eastern Bloc and the West. And in Somalia, you had overnight a complete and utter collapse, so that you had no schools, no police forces. You know, at one point, the electrical and telephone wires were being dragged out of the ground, all the copper. They blasted the front doors of the central bank and so on. So we had no language to describe this. And what was incredibly frustrating was that it was the most ghastly thing that happened in Somalia, and yet at the same time, the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, was just about to take place, and so it just happened completely off people's radar. And so you got the sense of a country where the lights were going out, and of course they were literally going out, and they ripped out the telephone system so that you couldn't even phone anywhere in the country. And the digits 252, which was the national code of Somalia, would just get you this sort of, you know, popping and wheezing ether as you try to phone into the country. It just disappeared off the map.
I think Somalia was the first time I remember hearing the word warlord.
Yes, I mean, we had no way of describing these militias and what their structure was and what their sort of anthropology was. And so it was in a Reuters office. I take claim for the fact that we came up with the word warlord to describe these militias. Someone would have come up with it sooner or later. But it was a sort of conversation that I was having with my bureau chief about these sort of bizarre creatures that didn't seem to come from any kind of political body that we'd ever seen suddenly emerging. I mean, they were basically massive criminals who had taken over the resources of what was left of the state. And so we christened them warlords, and the name stuck, much to the annoyance of the militia leaders themselves, who wanted to present themselves as Democrats and peace leaders.
You were thinking of what, warlocks and something?
Yeah, we were talking about a 1970s TV program, I don't know if you have it in the States, called Doctor Who, where there are these people called warlocks and Time Lords, and so we just conflated the two to come up with warlords.
You also reported on famine in the camps in Baidoa, and you write that to do the job well as a reporter, you have to depict the death of an individual. That's in order to successfully convey the tragedy of famine to your readers. Does that translate for you in the field, that you and your colleagues have to think up ever more novel ways to get across the horror?
Yes, I mean, I think that it's very obvious that when you're there, you also experience this this complete overload, because the number of people in the famine camps in Baidoa was so huge, and at one point 400 people were dying a day. as much as for the reporter as for his or her professional job, you had to try and humanize this huge anonymous suffering and come up with an individual story, and all too often it had a tragic end, but you in some ways tried to find something that was redeeming. But you know, very soon, very quickly, you started to lose any kind of humanity, I think, and the Somali famine for me was the point where I began to see the very sick aspects of the trade that that I worked in, that you know, we were trying to tease out a single person's death and make that into a story. And at one point I describe how a sound man for a television station had stuck his microphone into the face of a dying man, and as he rattled his last, the sound man took the microphone away and said, I've captured the sound of death. I wanted to do that for some time. You know, I mean, really, it's an unacceptable situation to be in, to be an observer in a situation like that.
Well, what effect did the experience of recording the famine have on you there and then?
Well, I went through this sort of narcolepsy where I would just fall asleep in my soup or fall asleep while interviewing somebody. It might be something that was quite extraordinarily important while I was interviewing them, but I just would just fall asleep. And otherwise, I found the sort of the rest of the bodily functions worked perfectly. In fact, you have this sort of increased appetite. It's quite disgusting how you can finish a huge meal at the end of the day and have an incredible sense of appetite despite everything that's going on around you. Of course, people came in for brief visits and they didn't eat. I remember an Irish delegation came in for 3 days and they didn't eat. But if you report that for a year, you can't do that. And in fact, all of the sort of pretensions of trying to, you know, be correct in an unacceptable situation just fall away.
Looking back, though, now, do you feel that perhaps that work was not the right thing to do? Or do you wish you had made other, I don't know, grander gestures to tell people, to alert the world that these people in Africa needed such desperate help?
Well, I say in the book that, you know, I think that, you know, maybe I could have done more. Maybe I could have gone on runs to raise money for charity or chained myself to the railings outside embassies or something like that. But really, that's a sort of rhetorical paragraph, because I'm really just trying to illustrate how hopeless it is. I mean, by the time the famine has got that bad, and I have to say, with reference to things like Liberia, once things have got as bad as they are, then you know, you're just going in with a whole bunch of band-aids trying to patch things up, but things aren't going to get better. And in the famine, I mentioned how almost an entire generation of children of a certain age, from infancy to about the age of five, just disappeared in the famine in 1992-93. And by the time that that food arrived and forces arrived to protect them, of course they did save other people, but those people, probably up to 300,000 people, were just gone, an entire generation of people. And so, you know, there's a sort of helplessness about it. It just shouldn't have happened in the first place.
I'm talking with Aidan Hartley. He's a former war correspondent for Reuters and other news organizations. He covered conflicts in Ethiopia, Somalia, Rwanda, and the Congo. His new memoir of growing up in Africa and his time as a journalist is The Zanzibar Chest. Aidan, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with former war correspondent Aidan Hartley. His memoir of growing up in Africa and his decade covering conflicts there is called The Zanzibar Chest. Well, you're scathing about the American intervention in Somalia. What were some of the biggest missteps, and what specific scenes did you report on that brought it home to you?
Well, how can you go from a country that is in utter ruin to a Western-style democracy within 2 years? It just doesn't happen. And also, how can you expect people who live in a society which is not in many ways similar to a Western society, for example, a Muslim society that doesn't really have much of a political role for women, and determine that councils have to be gender balanced? I'm not saying that councils shouldn't be gender balanced, but to sort of impose it from day one seems a little naive. And you know, basically, it was immediately rejected by the Somalis, who still had a little bit of a fight to go through. But really, you know, the UN should have been in there for the long haul. And instead of that, they thought that they could come up with a grab bag of solutions and implement them within a short period of time. And so you had, yes, you had completely bizarre scenes where, you know, from a compound in the middle of Mogadishu that could only be reached by helicopter because the UN officials were so terrified of actually driving through the streets to the airport to go out for their R&R, you would have buildings given over to big signs sort of looming in the dust storms, justice, humanitarian, and so on, all of these sort of departments that were implementing edicts that came over the ether from New York to run Somalia, and yet these people didn't even go out into the streets of Somalia. They didn't eat the food of Somalia. You know, they just ate sort of hamburgers and stuff that had been flown in. So it was utterly surreal, and I must say, not particularly unique in the last decade or so.
You're referring to parallels that you see between the situation in Somalia then and what is going on in Iraq now?
Well, to an extent, you know, I mean, I think that the situations obviously are very different. But really the hope, and I understand once again, there may be good intentions to deliver a country to a multi-party democracy with human rights and so on, but you can't do it in 2 years. You can't do it in 5 or 10. And you know, the commitment to the long haul is pretty onerous. I understand that. But that's what it's going to take if that's what you want. And in the case of Somalia, of course, they said, OK, well, this is a bit too much hassle, and they left the country after a period of 2 years, and the country has fallen in just utterly off the abyss. It's not a country. It's just a sort of Somali wild coast. And they just gave up. And so there's nothing to show for it for nearly a decade since they left.
You also covered the Rwandan genocide, and you write in your memoir that the memory of Rwanda sits like a tumor leaking poison into the back of my head. What are some of those memories that haunt you?
Okay, let me say first that throughout the trajectory of the book, some terrible things happen, but I always felt a great sense that somehow, including the Somalis, including the fact that they're still in the abyss, that they'll somehow pull through, because one of the things about travelling in Africa is that in situations of the greatest adversity, you see amazing behaviour, amazing tenacity, amazing resilience, and amazing humanity. And for me, Rwanda is the one area that I can't explain to myself. And to me, it's just a gap of explanation where history breaks down, where things happened that that, you know, are just haunting to the region, haunting to the people who covered it, and haunting to the international community for many, many years afterwards. The memories that I have, I give one example that sums them all up, which is how can you explain in historical terms observing one woman with a child tied to her back, chasing another woman with a child tied to her back, wielding a machete and going at her with it? That, for me, I don't have any kind of historical explanation for that. To have witnessed it, to me, is just one of the big questions that I'll go to the grave with.
Was there one moment in reporting on what was going on in Rwanda that brought home the futility of your writing about this situation?
Yes, and it's the title of one of the chapters, Lazarus. After the end of the genocide, when there was this enormous exodus of Hutu refugees into eastern Congo, we followed them. And there, a cholera epidemic took hold, and many thousands of people were killed. And so the peacekeepers, who should have been deployed during the genocide, who weren't deployed, arrived too late in the day and essentially became grave diggers. And they would dig these enormous pits, and they would bulldoze the bodies into the pits and cover them with quicklime and then cover them over with earth. And I was standing on the edge of a pit one day with a French Foreign Legionnaire, and they just covered the bodies over with quicklime, and we were looking down, waiting for a bulldozer to come and cover over all of the corpses. And from down in the pit, we saw movement, and we jumped down into the pit, and we scrabbled over these bodies, and we pulled out a little boy. And we cleaned him up on the edge of the pit, and we began talking to him. And I say in the book how ashamed I feel that I took out a notebook at that point, but I did. And then we took him back to a hospital near the airfield. And as we went, we felt this surge of optimism, because in this dreadful place in eastern Congo, where the sun had been blotted out by smoke, by thousands of bodies, driving past thousands of bodies, we felt that there was some hope, some ray of light. And both the Foreign Legionnaire and I delivered him to the hospital, and I wrote this story. And it was a story that, one of the few stories that I wrote that just went round the world, because people were just so inured to this hopeless news, this dreadful news, and suddenly there was this child, Dibadiragwa, his name was, who had come out of this grave and had survived. And I felt this amazing surge of optimism. And I went back the next day to the hospital, and I took some candy along, and I said, I'm looking for this kid. And there were a bunch of other kids there, who all of whom just didn't know what I was talking about. And I eventually found the nurse that we had delivered the child to, and I said, I'm here to see this boy. And the nurse said, no, dead. And I said, you know, what was wrong? And the nurse said, nothing was wrong. This child died, I think, of a broken heart. And for me, that was the end. I went back to the news tent where a French colonel was reporting on how this child had recovered. And, of course, all of the journalists went in good faith and reported on the recovery of this child, and I went and reported on its death, and no one used the story. I mean, I carried on travelling into Rwanda and Congo and places like that for several years afterwards, but for me, you know, I was not able to really ever get over that.
Aidan Hartley's memoir is The Zanzibar Chest. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Warner Brothers Pictures and Matchstick Men, a Ridley Scott film with Nicolas Cage and Sam Rockwell as a couple of pros in the small-time con, in theaters Friday, September 12th. And from Pantheon Books, a division of Random House Incorporated, publishers of the new biography Isaac Newton by James Glick, author of Chaos and Genius. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with journalist Aidan Hartley about how Africa changed his father, who was first sent there as an officer of the British Colonial Service. Hartley has a new memoir. And David Bianculli reviews two new DVD compilations, Rocky and Bullwinkle and Friends and The Simpsons. That and more. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Let's continue our interview with journalist Aidan Hartley. He grew up in England and Africa. His family has a colonial legacy that goes back four generations in the British Foreign Service. For over a decade, Hartley was a war correspondent for Reuters, covering conflicts in the Congo, Ethiopia, Somalia, and Rwanda. His new memoir of his experience as a foreign correspondent and his family's history in Africa is called The Zanzibar Chest. After your period in Rwanda, you went through kind of a hard time. It was also the time that your father died. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. In the time after I left Reuters, and I was starting to sort of wander around a bit, my father died, and that's what really sets off the book, because I was going through. The Zanzibar chest of the title, which is this ornately carved wooden box that my father used to keep his papers in his office at home on the Indian Ocean coast. And I was going through these papers and I found these documents, including my father's sort of memoirs and also the diaries of his close friend Peter Davey, who was a friend of his who had been killed some 50 years before, and that's what sets me off on the journey in the book.
Now, to give some history, you grew up shuttling between East Africa, between Kenya and England, because your father was a colonial officer originally, and later he ran his own ranch. What was his assignment early on from the head office?
He was an agricultural officer. His job was to, develop crops like cotton and do some irrigation and so on. I mean, he started off as a very young man in a very remote part of Eastern Africa, and he stayed for the rest of his life, and he grew to love the place very, very deeply. And it was something that I grew up in his shadow feeling as well. He didn't seek out trouble. He sought to grow trees and to help people and to be a farmer. Of course, he was within a colonial system that had its many faults, but he as an individual was a lovely man.
As a child, which did you feel more at home in, Africa or England?
Growing up, I always felt that East Africa, and most particularly Kenya, was my home. This was the place of my early memories, and because it was so difficult to live there in the turmoil of the politics in the 60s and 70s, and because my father had to go and work in other countries like Ethiopia and Somalia, I suppose that I began to associate Africa with my father. And one of my earliest memories was praying to our Father who art in Africa. And I suppose that I conflated the two and made it something that was my kind of ultimate goal to love, and I wanted it to love me back.
So your father was gone a lot. Was he traveling around with the irrigation projects, with the development projects?
Well, the story is that once he left the colonial service and became a farmer in the turmoil of the 1960s, our ranch in Tanzania was nationalized. And so my parents had nothing, and everything that they'd worked for many years was gone. And so my father got a succession of jobs with different organizations working on agricultural projects in some pretty exciting places in Ethiopia and Somalia and so on. And I remember these amazing trips to go and see him in places like eastern Ethiopia in the highlands or down in the desert. And, you know, this only fueled the fire. I just thought, I really want to get here rather than be stuck in some school in a nasty little rainy island like England. But it meant a great deal of absence. And the absence sort of continued until I was an adult and could get back and work as a reporter in his footsteps, in the sense that he had gone to all of these amazing, remote, rugged, wild places.
Well, shortly before he died, your father said to you, "We should never have come." So what was the context of that statement? And what was he really saying to you? Was he referring beyond himself to generations of your family who had pursued careers abroad and partaken in colonialism?
My father, when he went out to East Africa, was part of a system, but I think that during his life he came, because of his own individual experience, comes to draw his own conclusions about the system in which he lives. And he felt that the system that he had been employed by had made some dreadful mistakes. And at one point he describes this, he told me this story which I describe, which is that he had gone out and he was on this project to resettle a group of people. And he was going into an area of Western, now Tanzania, on the southern shores of Lake Victoria, to resettle people. And he was trying to go and identify some land. And he went into this village where he did something. He shot two impala antelope. And this seemed to be some seminal event which had been predicted by the people of the village. And this sort of rather, you know, lurid story he tells of how they brought him into the village and they began to dance, and they told him that he had fulfilled something that had been predicted. And he went off and later walked out of that village. And several days later, he suffered a nightmare in which he saw a shadowy figure at the end of his bed that in some way pursued him or threatened him, but made him feel that he should pursue or attack it. And through the years, he would jump out of high windows. During some period of insecurity in Kenya, when everybody was armed, he fired off pistols into the ceiling. Pretty mad stuff. And this went on for years and years. I think that there were times when he felt that our presence in East Africa had just basically, you know, torn the curtain in the temple, had destroyed and despoiled something that was beautiful. Of course, it was a romantic view. And it was something that he nevertheless had been able to observe through his life, because the Africa that he saw when he first arrived in the 1920s, he was very old when he had me, was a place that environmentally was not despoiled, where a society was living with a pretty, you know, a predatory nature and environment, but had nevertheless an organization and a society that had existed for many, many years without outside intervention quite well. And the 20th century was an extraordinarily traumatic time for Africa, when societies were destroyed, when the environment was despoiled, when completely alien ideas were introduced, when Africa was sort of wrenched out of the existence that it had led for centuries and sort of just plugged into the international economy, much against its will very often. And at the end of it, it was supposed to benefit from this whole process of wrenching out of its sort of its sleep and being made part of the international community. But what he had seen in 30 years of independence in Africa since the end of colonialism was nothing but dictatorship and suffering and neo-colonialism and sort of dreadful happenings. And so I think he felt pretty disappointed at the end of his life with what had happened. But in rejoinder to what he says, we should never have come, I say to him, but, you know, we stayed here. And the point is that I think one of the reasons why I admire my father very greatly is because he stayed on. There were lots of other people who just left, or they left after their contracts ended, or they left because they just gave up hope in Africa. And so, you know, I think that the life of my father described in the book is one that I write with a great deal of admiration, because he bore witness and he stuck it out. And that is something that I'm trying to copy.
You're no longer a war reporter. You live in Kenya with your wife and your children. What are you doing professionally?
Well, it took a long time to write this book, 6 years, and I spent a lot of time doing that until recently. I do some journalism, but of a very different kind. I have a column in the magazine Spectator, and I also farm. And I think at the end of this long experience of covering troubles, I now live in a rural Africa where I get to meet the sort of local notables and the police chief and the local chief and the various cattle traders and so on, and it's a very redemptive experience for me, because it proves to me that I can live in this place that I love and be a part of it, and I don't have to go around sniffing out bad news and getting depressed by it all the time. And the place where I live has many problems. I can see people who are so poor that they suffer malnutrition almost from my front window every year during the dry season. But at the same time, I live as part of the fabric of society in Kenya, as I never did when I was living in the city and, you know, belting out news on what presidents say and what the UN says. And so I find it a lot more of an enriching experience. I'm sort of in the trenches of trying to make the economy of Kenya work from ground level as a farmer with cattle and sheep and some organic honey and so on.
In your opinion, what does the United States not get about promoting democracy in Africa?
I think the time that it will take to achieve. I feel sorry and full of admiration for the people who have to go and deploy in countries and be shot at and so on. I think that I don't subscribe to any of the sort of anti-Americanism that a lot of Europeans do, in just taking an opportunistic pot shot at the Americans just because they either do something or they don't do something. But I think that for the Americans, it's something that they feel uncomfortable with because they don't want to have an empire. It goes against what your founding fathers prescribed for your nation. And I can quite understand that. But at the same time, there has to be a long-term policy, which is a coherent one. And it's not about just grabbing Bush a few votes here and there. It's about the fact that you can't have, which is what is in existence at the moment, a policy whereby you just sort of transport the harvest of grain from somewhere like Nebraska and just dump it on Africa and call that a policy. And you can't do it by short-term military interventions that don't set up an administration that can take root. And, I mean, no one's saying it is easy. It's unbelievably difficult. But we are in here for the long haul. And that's talking about 3 decades, not 2 years or 3 years.
Aidan Hartley, thank you so much for talking with me today. It was really interesting.
Thank you very much, Barbara.
Aidan Hartley is the author of a memoir, The Zanzibar Chest. Coming up, a review of 2 new DVDs of cartoon series. This is Fresh Air. Most durable and influential primetime cartoon series in TV history are now compiled in new DVD box sets. This week, Sony released the complete first season of Rocky and Bullwinkle and Friends. Later this month, Fox Home Entertainment presents the complete third season of The Simpsons. TV critic David Bianculli heartily endorses them both.
And now...
Hey, Rocky, watch me pull a rabbit out of my hat.
Again?
Not enough my sleeve. Presto! No doubt about it. I gotta get another hat.
Now here's something we hope you'll really like.
Matt Groening, who created The Simpsons, used to watch Rocky and Bullwinkle as a kid. He loved it, but noticed that his dad loved it too, and laughed in spots where Matt couldn't figure out why. That's because Jay Ward's Rocky and Bullwinkle was aimed at adults as well as kids and contained lots of jokes and especially bad puns that no grade school kid could be expected to get. The show's chief villain was a Cold War spy named Boris Badenov. I think I was in my 20s before I discovered that his name was a play on an opera, Boris Godunov. Other jokes were a bit less obscure, but no less clever. like the tiny jewel-encrusted toy boat called the Ruby Yacht of Omar Khayyam. Or the lion tamer, whose name, instead of Clyde Beatty, was Claude Badley. Or the time when Bullwinkle the Talking Moose, after having collected a wheelbarrow full of cereal box tops, wheeled them into a bank where he's suspected of counterfeiting.
Could we have a little service, please?
Yes, sir, certainly, sir. Arbogast, call the police, the FBI, my wife.
I'd like to start a box top account with your bank.
Yes, sir. What kind? Just checking?
No, I really mean it.
If you're old enough to remember when box tops could be redeemed for prizes, then you probably remember and treasure all the wonderful elements of this series. If not, you're in for a very twisted treat. There's Mr. Peabody, the time-traveling dog, and his pet boy Sherman. Edward Everett Horton narrating Fractured Fairy Tales. Dudley Do-Right of the Canadian Mounties, and so on. Jay Ward launched Rocky and His Friends as a late-afternoon cartoon series for ABC in 1959. 2 years later, it moved to primetime on NBC and was retitled The Bullwinkle Show. This DVD set, for continuity purposes, presents both series under the same umbrella title, Rocky and Bullwinkle and Friends. But what's being released this week, for the first time in almost half a century, is the complete first season of Rocky and His Friends. The animation is crude, but the jokes are sharp. And it's very clear to see where The Simpsons came from. The Simpsons, of course, doesn't need any sales pitch from me or anybody else. The releases of its first two seasons are the best-selling DVD sets in history, and pre-orders for season three make it three in a row. On DVD, The Simpsons would be worth buying even if it didn't offer any extras. But the alternate audio commentary on many of these episodes is just as much fun as the shows themselves. Listen to the large cast of characters crammed into the recording booth to comment on one episode here, and how quickly they get into the funny spirit of the thing.
Hello, my name is Rich Moore. I'm the director of this episode, which is titled Stark Raving Dad.
This is David Silverman, supervising director.
Hello, I'm Julie Kavner, and this is one of my favorite episodes.
This is Dan Castellaneta, voice of Homer and others.
This is Matt Groening.
Hi, Al Gina is one of the showrunners and one of the writers of this episode.
Hi, this is Jim Brooks, and would we all agree that at the time, given everything, this was the biggest guest star in the show's history?
Yeah,
absolutely. Oh, definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What I remember was Michael Jackson had said he wanted to do the show. So Jim
called up. First of all, you got to realize that you actually have Michael Jackson on the phone.
I was working in the office by myself late one night, and the phone rang. Hi, it's Michael Jackson. And I thought, I couldn't believe it. And really, it was a back and forth for about a minute before I finally believed that it was actually Michael Jackson.
Okay, okay. It's this many years later. Hi, I'm Michael Jackson.
The Simpsons' third season is beautifully packaged, loaded with extras, and offers 24 episodes worth of one of TV's best and funniest cartoon comedies. It's another great example why DVD players and DVD box sets are selling so quickly. The sales figures for the Rocky and Bullwinkle set won't be quite so astounding. But they should be. Rocky and Bullwinkle and The Simpsons are the best of their genre and deserve to be sitting next to each other on the same home video shelf. That's where they are on mine, and, I suspect, on Matt Groening's.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, we revisit an issue raised last week about truth in memoir writing. This is Fresh Air.
Hello.
We're taking a few minutes now to follow up on an issue that arose on our show last week. When you read a memoir, do you assume that everything in the book has really happened? Or do you expect that the writer has taken certain artistic liberties? Our book critic Maureen Corrigan talked about this question last week when, instead of reviewing a new book, she discussed her reaction to a new controversy about the author of the revered memoir Fierce Attachments. Vivian Gornick's 1987 memoir is about her relationship with her mother. 2 weeks ago, Gornick spoke at Goucher College to students in a master's program for creative nonfiction. Many of these students are already professional writers. Gornick explained that some of her writing did not describe events exactly as they actually happened. She said she had composed some scenes and conversations in the memoir, and that some scenes were composites of two or more incidents. After reading an article in Salon magazine about Gornick's seminar, Maureen said that Gornick broke the autobiographer's pledge to tell the truth. Maureen also said that she hadn't been this disheartened since historian Doris Kearns Goodwin was accused of plagiarism, or Benjamin Wilkomirski's Holocaust memoir was revealed to be a fraud. Vivian Gornick asked us if she could respond with her point of view about the responsibilities of the memoirist. She called us from Yaddo, the artist colony in upstate New York.
A memoir is a story taken directly from the raw material of a writer's own life and shaped into a piece of experience that can hold meaning for the disinterested reader. What actually happened is only material. What the writer makes of what happened is everything. To state the case briefly, memoirs belong to the category of literature, not of journalism. It is a misunderstanding to read a memoir as though the writer owes the reader the same record of factual accuracy that is owed in newspaper reporting or in literary journalism. What is owed is only the ability to persuade that the narrator is honestly trying to get to the bottom of the experience at hand. 2 weeks ago, I spoke about memoir writing at Goucher College before a group of writing program students and their teachers. At a question and answer period afterward, I was bombarded with questions that had more to do with the literal actuality of the events behind my own memoir than with any of the writing questions I had assumed the talk would generate. In the course of responding to these questions, I casually said what I had said many times before, that on a few occasions in the book, I made a composite out of the elements of two or more incidents, none of which had been fabricated, for the purpose of moving the narrative forward. These words were taken as a confession on my part, and a student in the audience rushed off to send the scandalous news to Salon magazine. Whereupon, Fresh Air's book critic subsequently denounced me on this program, comparing me with those other liars, Benjamin Wilkomirski, Doris Goodwin, and Jason Blair. The giveaway here is this trio of names. I, a memoirist who composed, mind you, not invented, a narrative drawn entirely from my own experience, and being compared to a psychopath, a plagiarizing historian, and a dishonest newspaper reporter. These wildly inappropriate analogies demonstrate sadly that memoir writing is a genre still in need of an informed readership.
Vivian Gornick is the author of Fierce Attachments and The Situation in the Story, The Art of Personal Narrative. She was responding to a commentary by our book critic Maureen Corrigan. We asked Maureen to give her reaction.
Gornick and I are in agreement that the person who writes the autobiography is not the same as the person who lives the life, and that memoirs are works of literature. I said so last Tuesday. Where we disagree is on the issue of responsibility. Specifically, the responsibility a seemingly conventional memoir like hers has to its readers. Each and every autobiography instructs its readers on how to read it. Many famous autobiographies, like Mary McCarthy's Memories of a Catholic Girlhood and Gertrude Stein's Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, intermingle fact and fiction, condense scenes, play with chronology, or otherwise acknowledge the indeterminacy of absolute truth that thinkers from Freud to Foucault have taught us is a defining condition of modernity. These autobiographies are explicit about their indirect efforts to capture experience on the page. Other autobiographies include a prefatory note stating that some scenes or characters have been fictionalized.
But when the writer of a memoir or an autobiography doesn't provide one of these ambivalent signals, readers tend to take her at her word. They assume she's forged her art out of a good faith accounting of her life, as she honestly understood and remembered it. Yes, what the writer makes of what happened, as Gornick says, will determine a work's power as art. Thus, even a memoir found to be wholly fictitious can stand as an artistic creation. But the truth, always imperfectly evoked, attaches readers to other lives actually lived across barriers of time and space, race and gender, and attaches the writer to the genre's ancestral origins in Augustine's and Rousseau's outsized efforts to, however impossibly, wholly know themselves. In its steely unattainability, the truth demands either an acknowledgement from the autobiographer that it will be playfully deconstructed, or a utopian determination to get it right, even if, inevitably, it turns out to be somewhat wrong. It adds insult to injury to be told by the autobiographer in question that in accepting the conventional autobiographical contract that the writer is indeed trying to write the truth, you as a reader are a dope.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Ian Chillog directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Moth Diaries, a novel about obsessions that drive people through adolescence by author Rachel Klein. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with director Terry Gilliam. The story of his disastrous attempt to make a film based on Don Quixote is the subject of the documentary Lost in La Mancha, now out on DVD. Also, we meet Mike Judge, creator of the Fox animated series King of the Hill. A DVD of the first season was just released. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.